Professor Galwa, Jewish History 101.
101.
101. Things most people never learn in school.
Or anywhere else, I suppose.
Thank you for your indulgence. I teach until 10-2. Usually no student ever comes and asks me a question, but of course today students came and asked me a question. What do I do with the recording? It is in Windows Media Audio format, which I then transfer to an MP3 format, and I post it on my website for anybody who would like to listen to it in the future. So that is what I do with these things. Now, the topic is American Jewish History 101, Things Most People Never Learn in School. Actually, the topic was originally Things You Never Learned in School, but Harold changed it because he felt that there might be somebody who knew these things. But let me first of all express my appreciation for being back here again. Each semester, Harold is kind enough to invite me. You know, when I finish a lecture, sometimes somebody says to me, well, how'd the lecture go? I say, you have to ask the victims, not me. How did the students feel about it? So I guess, since I'm invited back, either I'm doing something right or you people are masochists and you like to come and be subjected to this. Let me mention some names. Just throw out some names. See if they ring a bell. Aaron Lopez, Dr. Samuel Nunes, David Mercado, Rebecca Mercado Phillips, Louis Moses Gomez, David Gomez, Benjamin Gomez, Isaac Leeser, Abraham I. Abrahams, the Raskis family of St. Louis, Rebecca Gratz, Jacob Mordechai, Arthur Levy. Arthur Levy may ring a bell because there's an Arthur Levy place in Manhattan. Jacob Bar Simpson, Rabbi Abraham Rice, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman, Harry Fischel, Gershon Kershid. Some places. Now, most of them probably do not ring a bell with anybody. Well, here, but they are key figures. They were key figures in American Jewish history. Some places: Recife, Curacao, Suriname, Nevis, Savannah, Philadelphia, Richmond, New Orleans, Warrenton, North Carolina. Warrenton, North Carolina. Jamaica, Newport, St. Louis, etc. You heard of the places, but what they have to do with Jewish history, by the way, American Jewish history is the Jewish history of North, Central, and South America. I once got zapped in an email by a fellow from Mexico saying that you refer to American Jewish history as North America, and there's a lot of American Jewish history, and there was in Mexico. There was the Inquisition in Mexico, in fact, and there's a lot of American Jewish history in South America. I became interested in American Jewish history, I guess now it's going on 4 years. But I have a focus which not too many people seem to have taken. Given my bent, given my religious orientation, I focus on people who struggle to remain observant in America despite almost insurmountable obstacles. And we're going to talk today about a few people. People who there isn't much written upon about, except if you search and look for my articles, because my interest in American Jewish history has led to my writing a monthly column called Glimpses into American Jewish History for something called the Jewish Press, as well as a number of front page articles in the Jewish Press about various personalities. How do I get the information? Because after all, the information is the key. The American Jewish Historical Society, published starting in the late 1880s, early 1890s, a journal. And all of that up till 1978 is online, and it's searchable. For me, that's a marvel, and it's a freebie. For me, that's a marvelous resource. I can go in there, search, and pull out articles and get information. In addition, don't spread it around too much, but the Stevens Library is very helpful to me. Leah Kaufman has been very helpful in getting articles, because from 1978 on, the journals of the American Jewish Historical Society were taken over by Johns Hopkins, and you need a special access, which Stevens doesn't have, so I can't get at those articles. And there are also various other articles in other places. In addition, the Dorot Division of the New York Public Library, people there have been very helpful and haven't charged me a penny, which is quite amazing. They find things, send things to me, and without any charge. We're going to speak about, first of all, a gentleman by the name of Israel Bear Kurshid, K-U-R-S-H-E-E-D-T, 1766 to 1852. What I'm going to talk about is based on a paper called The Asmonean, which was a Jewish newspaper in the 19th century. The article appeared in 1852 at his passing. I got that through the Dorot Division of the New York Public Library, and also from something called The Occident, which was a publication of Isaac Leeser. Isaac Leeser was a chazan, a cantor, in Philadelphia in the 19th century. He was in the forefront of everything Jewish in this country during the 19th century, and he published the first Jewish periodical in English to appear in this country. There's one other source that I should have mentioned, and that is my friend, Yosef Goldman. Yosef Goldman is a rare book collector. He deals in rare books, and he has in his house perhaps the finest collection of American Jewish books, certainly in the country. He produced a two-volume set of Hebrew books published in America from the beginning till 1927. There's a technical reason why he stopped in 1927, and he gives you a facsimile of the book. He tells you about the author. He tells you about the book. These are all books that have Hebrew in them, and then he tells you where you can find them, and virtually everything can be found in the Joseph Goldman collection, which is in his house. It's all sitting there. I went to visit him the first time. He opened up a cabinet and took out a book. He says, "See, this is the first Siddur." Actually, it's not prayer book. It's the first Machzor for the high holidays, a prayer book for the high holidays, published in America. Just sitting there. He says to me, "It's worth more than a house in Flatbush." I looked at him, but he's got all this stuff. So whatever I need, he's willing to supply to me. It's in the 1760s or something like that.
Where does he live? Don't tell.
Lives in Flatbush. Okay. So we're going to talk now, first of all, about Israel Bear Kurshid. Let's understand a little bit about early American Jewry. Jews came to America in 1654. They actually ended up coming here as refugees from Recife in Brazil.
Was he Jewish?
I do not believe he was. I do not believe he was. There's a back and forth about whether or not Columbus was Jewish. I do not believe he was. A gentleman named of Kaiserling wrote a very detailed book about all of the Jews who assisted Columbus, because Columbus used navigation charts and stuff like that that were produced by Jews, and there's absolutely no mention that Columbus was a Jew. There were certainly some Muranos who went with him, but I do not believe that Columbus was a Jew. Do not believe so. In any case, In 1630, the Dutch conquered a section of Brazil that was under the control of the Portuguese formerly. Now, let's understand something. Spain, Portugal, Catholic Church equals Inquisition. The Jews were petrified of this. They were persecuted by it. They did their best to get away from it. And a number of Jews, or secret Jews, they're called Muranos or New Christians, came to America thinking that it would be easier to avoid the Inquisition because the establishment of the state was not so tight-knit as it was in the old country. and came to America also. There were opportunities here. Jews were involved in sugar and trade and things like that, but they lived outwardly as Christians. In 1630, the Dutch conquered Recife, Brazil. It's a town on the Brazilian coast. And a strange thing happened. The Dutch were very, very tolerant when it came to Jews. Many Jews who lived in Portugal and Spain did their best to get to Amsterdam, where one could practice Judaism openly. There all of a sudden appeared a whole bunch of Jews out of the woodwork. And a Jewish community appeared. And in fact, in 1642, Amsterdam sent several rabbis, together with various other functionaries, to serve the Jewish community. There were two synagogues, at least in Recife. There was a religious education school from elementary up to advanced. In a certain sense, Recife was a suburb of Amsterdam, Jewishly. What's interesting about Recife is that it's the only instance in the New World in which an entire body of qualified personnel, religiously qualified, came to America to serve a community. In 1654, the Dutch lost the battle to the Portuguese. The Portuguese reconquered Recife. The Jews were told they could stay if they wanted to. They didn't want to. They were allowed to leave. They were allowed to take most of their property. And they left in mass. Some estimates say 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 Jews, thousands of Jews left. A lot of them went back to Amsterdam. A number of them went to small communities in the Caribbean. And one boat ended up in New York, in New Amsterdam. And that's how the Jews came to America in 1654. In any case, there were no religious officials, no really qualified religious officials in America from 1654 until 1840, when the first ordained Orthodox rabbi arrived in America, Abraham Rice, in 1840. When he came to America, he went to Baltimore, that's where his pulpit was, and he found absolute chaos in the Jewish community. And he wrote very bitterly that there was no hope for Judaism in this country. In any case, until then, Chazanim, the cantors who were better educated, certain of the laymen who were better educated, served the Jewish community as religious officials. But there was a great deal of chaos. It was so bad that many European communities would not accept what's called a get. A get is a bill of divorce that separates a Jewish man from his wife. Without that get, she cannot remarry according to Jewish law. They would not accept a get or a certificate of conversion from America. They just felt people didn't know what they were doing here. They didn't know what they were doing here. There was one Talmud Chacham who came to America before 1800. His name, again, is Israel Ber Kirschit. Kirschit, as a youth, was born in Singhafen, Germany, near the Rhine, on April 6, 1766. He was orphaned at a young age. His mother relocated to Kirschit, which is where he took his last name from, because many Jews did not have last names in Europe. And he showed, as a youth, a certain brilliance in his Torah studies, and as a result, he was sent to yeshiva of somebody by the name of Rav Nosson Adler, Nathan Adler. Nathan Adler is 1741 to 1800, and he was in Frankfurt, Germany. Adler was a genius. Adler was a world-recognized Torah authority. According to Jewish tradition, most things are not supposed to be written down. According to Jewish tradition, the Torah, the five books of Moses, and then the later books of the prophets were given. Those were to be written down. But all of the commentary and stuff was not to be written down. And the Talmud, the Gemara, was not to be written down. It was memorized. And it's only because after a certain point, people began to forget. For example, there were no prayer books. There were absolutely no prayer books until the first one is in the 9th century. No prayer books written down. People memorized it. They memorized everything. Now, at a certain point, it became obvious that it was necessary to write things down. So they began to write things down. But Adler never wrote anything down. He said the whole reason allowing people to write things down is because they forget things. But I never forget anything, so I'm not allowed to write anything down. And so we have from him a certain book, what's in it, a little dots in places. Nobody has any idea what it means. But he was a brilliant Torah authority, and Kershey came to his yeshiva, his rabbinical college, to study. The most famous student of Nosson Adler is somebody called Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, called the Chassam Sofa. He had a number of famous students. Kershid had fellow students, two of whom were a Rabbi Abraham Bing and a Rabbi Wolf Heidenheim. They both earned national, international acclaim in Jewish circles for their efforts. And Rabbi Adler said that they were all of equal standing in terms of their Torah knowledge. He said that Rabbi Bing was an acute logician, Rabbi Wolf was a grammarian, and Israel Ber Kershid was a chacham, a wise man whose accomplishments in Torah learning were universal. So he was no small man, this Israel Ber Kershid. He became an accomplished Torah scholar. His studies were interrupted in 1792 by the French Revolution. And General Adam Kustin invaded Frankfurt. And the question was, where should his troops camp? Now, there was a beautiful park in Frankfurt, but Jews were not allowed to enter it. Germany was very, very discriminatory towards the Jews. They had to pay special taxes and this and that. Jews were not allowed to enter this park. One of the officers of Kustin's army asked the Jew, where should they camp? So he suggested, go into the park. That's the best place for you. Of course, they wrecked the park. That was what he wanted, because he felt that discrimination was totally out of place. In any case, Kershid became a supplier to the Prussian army. How a boy or a young man who had been trained in a yeshiva environment, in a cloistered environment, was able to get involved in business relations with the Prussian army, I don't know. After all, there was danger dealing with the one army, the other army could arrest you. But he got involved in a business and became quite lucrative. He became successful. However, peace came in 1795, and that ended his business operations. So he decided he wanted to leave Germany, felt the conditions for Jews in Germany were terrible, and he was going to come to London. He went to Hamburg to board a ship to London, but there was no ship going to London, but there was a ship going to Boston. And he had heard that there was a vibrant Jewish community in Boston, so he booked passage on something called the Simonhof. That's a 70 to 80 ton vessel, that's a little boat, and the passage took him 70 days to get here to America. Now here's a man who spoke no English, obviously. He is in a totally alien environment, and he boarded the ship shortly before the Jewish high holidays. So he has certain religious needs that he would like in some way or other to be accommodated to in some way, as much as possible. What did he do? He knew the verses in the Bible in the Hebrew, and he knew the numbering in the Bible. By the way, the numbering in the Bible is not of Jewish origin, it is of Catholic origin. I don't know if you're aware of that, but it is. But it's in the Hebrew Bible also. He knew the numbering, and therefore he pointed to the verses associated with the religious holidays. And in this way, he was able to communicate to the captain, who treated him nicely. He arrived in Boston at the end of 1796, and he discovered the following. The entire Jewish community consisted of one Jewish family. There was nothing there. So, shortly thereafter, he decided to go to New York, where he knew there was a Jewish community. In fact, there was a quote-unquote vibrant Jewish community. Now, what did it mean to have a vibrant Jewish community in New York? Here are some statistics from, there's a book by Grinstein called The Rise and Fall of the New York Jewish Community. And he gives the Jewish population of New York. So in 1695, there were 100 Jews out of 4,000 people. They were 2.5% of the population. In 1750, the Jewish community consisted of 300 people. In 1794, 350 people. They were 1.1% of the population. In 1809, 450. In 1850, 350. In 1820, 450. In 1825, 500. In 1836, now they were up to a huge 2,000. Jews were a small, small percentage of the overall population. And New York was a center of Judaism. New York had a synagogue. That was a big thing. That was a big thing. Israel's first impression of Jewish life in New York must have left him crestfallen. In material terms, the Jewish community consisted of a synagogue building on Mill Street dating back to 1730, an adjoining Hevra meeting place and schoolhouse, the minister's house, and a cemetery on Chatham Square. Its upkeep was the cause of frequent outbreaks, that is, disagreements among the trustees of Sherith Israel. Sherith Israel is the first congregation founded in New York. It still exists, although not in the same location. He says, the Jews of New York knew little of Jewish traditions. Neglect, apathy, and petty bickering were pervasive. Doesn't seem like much has changed in the world now, does it? Doesn't seem like much has changed. He was here not for very long when he met a gentleman by the name of Gershom Mendes Sheishes. S-E-I-X-E-S. Sheishes is 1745 to 1860. He was appointed the chazan, that is the reader, the cantor of Sherith Israel, of the congregation, at the age of 23. He was American trained, by the way. He was born here in America and trained in America. He was not a rabbi, but he served almost 50 years. He served the congregation for almost 50 years. He's known as the patriotic chazan, the patriotic cantor. Because during the Revolutionary War, by the way, the vast overwhelming majority of Jews sympathized with the revolution and not with the British. And when the British were going to capture New York, the Jewish community virtually en masse left. Most of them went to Philadelphia. He, Sheishes, went to Philadelphia and spent the Revolutionary War there. He quickly made the acquaintance of Israel Ber Kershit, and he could appreciate what Kershit was, because he was a man who was a first-rate, as we say in the vernacular, Talmud Chochem, an expert in Jewish rabbinical studies, something unheard of in America at the time. So he appreciated his learning. On January 18th, 1804, Kershit married Sarah Abigail Sally Sheishes. That's the eldest daughter of Chazan Sheishes, of Cantor Sheishes. Sarah was the favorite child of Reverend Sheishes, and Israel Ber Kershit became the favorite son-in-law, his favorite son-in-law. In New York, Kershit went into business. And now it says in the Asmonean, which is in his write-up of after his death, he had his share both of prosperity and of adversity, like all other men. But the one never rendered him arrogant, and the other could not cast him down. There were in his character two remarkable traits that still kept him upright and enabled him to preserve the serenity of his mind: trust in God and good opinion of men. He was incapable of believing in the bad intentions of others. And though he, more than once or twice, suffered severely from his confidence being abused, he could not be persuaded that the cause was other than imprudence or folly on the part of those through whom he suffered. His trust in God was firm and not to be shaken, as it sprung from his profound conviction of the truth of his religion, and consequently in the wisdom and goodness of Providence. He was a man who then had a growing family, and it was only natural, given his background, given his interest, that he should become involved in Jewish education. And he became involved in something called Yeshivat Minchat Arab, which was a parochial school that was founded in 1731 by Sherith Israel to educate their children. In 1808, he was appointed to a committee of six to draft a detailed proposal and regulations for the reorganization of the yeshiva into a real Jewish day school for boys and girls. Now, one has to understand that education for girls, both in the secular world and in the Jewish religious world, was very, very skimpy. And the fact that they emphasized education for women also was very, very forward-looking. The school remained active until 1822. Its aims, as articulated by Kirschied, were to instruct students in religion and morality, to make sure their actions are in harmony with those with these teachings, and to impress on their minds the excellence of our belief. In 1810, in recognition for his service to the Jewish community, Israel Ber Kirschied was elected Parnes, that is, president of Sherith Israel, and served for one term. He fought many battles at Sherith Israel. One of the things that people who attend certain synagogues find annoying is there's a custom that if somebody gets an honor, when they're called up for that honor, they ask for something called a mishaberach. That is a blessing for themselves, for their family, for their extended family, for who knows who. Now, when you ask for that, you pay money for that. Okay? You make a donation. That's the way it works. Now, as you can imagine, if somebody goes up and has relatives and cousins and extended cousins, and it can take forever. Kirschied wanted to limit the number of such blessings that could be made to three per person. They wouldn't hear of it. They couldn't afford to lose the money. They wouldn't hear of it. Any case, he relocated to Richmond, Virginia, where he lived from 1812 to 1824. He went to Richmond because he had business failings in New York. There he became the chazan, the cantor of the Richmond Synagogue. There he met Isaac Lisa, whom I mentioned earlier, who was in the forefront of everything Jewish in the 19th century. He met a gentleman named Jacob Mordechai, who was a pioneer in women's education. Jacob Mordechai started in the very beginning, early 1800s, a female academy for studies for high school girls, not a Jewish school. And the basic belief was that girls couldn't learn academic subjects. It was beyond their mind. But he gave them a rigorous curriculum and proved that it could be done. And his school was a success. It was a phenomenon. It was a real success. So Jacob Mordechai. While residing in Virginia, Kirschied became acquainted with none other than Thomas Jefferson, and even visited him on more than one occasion in Monticello.
Jefferson was Jewish. No, he's French.
He returned to New York, and by this time he was a family of 11. He had 9 children. New York's Jewish community had changed a great deal in the 12 years the Kirschieds had lived in Richmond. The majority of the Jewish community was now of Ashkenazic. Now, that's something I should have mentioned. The Jews in Brazil, in Recife, were of Spanish-Portuguese origin. That's called Sfardim. Okay? And they were known as La Nación, as the nation, because they had resisted secretly the Inquisition. They were considered the nobility, and every synagogue founded in America in the beginning followed the Spanish-Portuguese ritual. But what happened was, very quickly, Jews began to immigrate, particularly from Germany, and they were Ashkenazic. That's a different type. Those are Eastern European or European Jews. And the pronunciation is different, and while the liturgy is essentially the same, there's enough of a difference to annoy you if you know the difference.
Food.
The food is different. The culture is different. Everything is different. That's right. That's
pronunciation
right.
Pronunciation of Hebrew.
Of Hebrew, yes. 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 What?
And the melodies.
And the melodies, everything is different. Everything is different, okay? The Sephardic Jewry is more of an Oriental sound, and the Ashkenaz is not at all that way. Okay.
Circumcision more or less the same?
Yes. 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 I don't know why that's necessary to mention, but in any case,
it's important to me.
Since now the overwhelming number of Jews in New York were not of the Spanish-Portuguese type, they were the Ashkenazic type, they wanted to have a synagogue that was familiar to what they were used to. And Khurshid first tried to start a service within Sherith Israel that would cater to the Ashkenazic. The people in charge of Sherith Israel would not hear of it, and therefore he was involved in the founding of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun, which was New York's second oldest congregation, and it followed the Ashkenaz ritual. In 1834, he played a key role in the establishment of something called Chevra Trumas HaKodesh. This was a society that collected money to aid the poor Jews who lived in Israel, in the land of Israel. The Jews who lived in Israel, they were not many at this time in the 19th century. They were poor, and they were supported by the diaspora, by Jews who did not live in Israel. On August 19, 1840, he chaired a gathering of New York's Jewish community to protest something called the Damascus Affair. What was the Damascus Affair? When a Franciscan friar and his Muslim servant disappeared, the Jews of Damascus were accused of having killed them to use their blood for the Jewish Passover rites. This is the blood libel which has followed us for centuries. The idea that the Jews kill Christians, particularly Christian children, take their blood and use them to bake the Passover matzahs. The fact that the Bible, the Torah, forbids all blood, the fact that this is anathema to anyone Jewish, doesn't seem to matter. And this has persisted, by the way, down to today. Not so many years ago, there was an article in a Saudi newspaper by a professor at a Saudi college explaining how Jews use Christian blood to bake what are called humantashen. Those are special cake that's used at the time of Purim. And he gave all the directions and everything. In any case, there was a blood libel in Damascus. The Jews were rounded up. They were tortured. And they were made to confess. Some Jews died. Even Jewish children were taken prisoner. The Jewish community, this was the first time that the Jewish community in America protested an international incident. And eventually, with the intervention of authorities, Sir Moses Montefiore and others, the Jews were freed. Let's talk about the last days of Israel Ber Khurshid. Hyman Greenstein writes on page 220 of his classic, The Rise of the Jewish Community of New York, Israel Ber Khurshid, whose rabbinical knowledge was undoubtedly outstanding in the city in the first half of the 19th century, was a retiring person who rarely went out of his way to make his influence felt in the community. When he was approached on legal or ritual problems, he would prepare an answer. Occasionally, he led a movement or made a suggestion. His leadership was not aggressive, nor did he leave any books as tangible monuments to his scholarship. There's another reason, by the way, why he didn't have such an effect, and that is nobody really appreciated what he was. In order to appreciate the value of a Talmudic scholar, just like in order to appreciate, say, somebody who's a great mathematician, you have to know something about mathematics. You have to know something about the subject matter. There was nobody around to appreciate him. However, he had his greatest effect on his children. He had 9 children, and all of them, save for one, married Jews. The one who didn't never married. Now, you may say, well, what's the big deal? In the 19th century, the intermarriage rate was unbelievably high. And the fact that he accomplished this because he gave his children the best possible Jewish education he could is amazing. According to the Asmonean obituary, IBK was more than beloved by his family. He was almost idolized. His family devoted themselves to caring for him during the last 2 years of his life when he was ill and suffering. During this period, he was confined to his home, and many came to visit him simply to be in the presence of a man who was a living example of a true Jewish patriarch. He passed away at age 86, surrounded by family and friends. Someone present at his passing, witnessing his serenity of spirit, involuntarily burst out in the words of Scripture, "May I die the death of the righteous, and may my end be like his." One of Kershit's sons was Gershom Kershit, who was instrumental in getting Judah Turo to give large amount of money to Jewish causes. Let's now jump to something completely different.
Just a point of information. So he had tremendous rabbinical knowledge, but he wasn't a rabbi.
Right. Being a rabbi...
So you can have a congregation without a rabbi.
You can have a congregation without... In Orthodox circles, the average person... Okay, I have a grandson who is 14 who can get up and lead the service with no problem. With no problem. Rafo, you down for the Omer? Yeah, he goes up and he does it. Okay? Because he's in a special school where he's trained to do this. So no, in fact, rabbis have no special powers or privileges in Judaism. Rabbi means teacher. It's simply a sign that somebody is better educated. Somebody is better educated. Let's now jump to something completely different, to a place called Nivus. The sister islands of the Federation of St. Kitts and Nivus lie about 225 miles southeast of Puerto Rico. N-E-V-I-S. Nivus. Nevis.
Islands,
yeah. They lie southwest of Puerto Rico in the Leeward Islands in the Eastern Caribbean. Charleston, Nivus, was a central port in the 18th century. Sugar was a big product. The Jews were living there by 1677. Jews, 17 families. That was the whole Jewish community. It was a forgotten Jewish community. Nobody knew that it was even there until a gentleman by the name of Dr. Malcolm Stern, a historian, was on a pleasure cruise in 1957. And when they stopped for a couple of hours in Nevis, he was told that there's a Jewish cemetery. A Jewish cemetery? He never heard of such a thing. So he went, and he went to the cemetery. It was in total, you know, it was totally not maintained. But he then wrote down some of the inscriptions on the tombstones that he could read. And then he remembered the following. He remembered that Alexander Hamilton was born in Nevis. He was born in Nevis. And Hamilton had attended the Jewish school in Nevis. Why did Hamilton attend the Jewish school in Nevis? No. No. Steve, you want to make everybody Jewish. You're just, it's ridiculous. Hamilton's mother had been married to John Michael Lavien. He was a Jew. He was a Danish Jew. But it was not clear that she was properly divorced from him. And Alexander Hamilton was from another man who had had relations with her, and therefore there was a cloud of illegitimacy over him. And the Christian church would not allow him to be a member and would not allow him to attend school. So what did they do? They put him in the Jewish school. And Hamilton recalled from time to time how at a young age, he was a short boy, he stood on the table and he could recite the Decalogue in Hebrew. So he knew Hebrew. He knew Hebrew. And in fact, his son later related that rarely as he alluded to his personal history, he mentioned with a smile his having been taught to repeat the Decalogue in Hebrew at the school of a Jewess when so small that he was placed standing by her side upon a table. Perhaps from this exposure at an impressionable age, Hamilton harbored a lifelong reverence for Jews. In later years, he privately jotted on a sheet of paper that the progress of the Jews from their earliest history to the present time has been and is entirely out of the ordinary course of human affairs. Is it not then a fair conclusion that the cause also is an extraordinary one? In other words, that it is the effect of some great providential plan? Later on, in the heat of a renowned legal case, Hamilton challenged the opposing counsel. Why distrust the evidence of the Jews? Discredit them and you destroy the Christian religion. Now let's jump to something else.
That's why he fell in love with Alexander Burr, another Jew.
Aaron Burr. Now let's jump to the Raskas family of St. Louis. I don't know if anybody here is from the Midwest. There used to be, still is, I believe, a famous dairy conglomerate, Raskas. They were famous for cream cheese and various other dairy products. In any case, in 1882, Shalom Yitzchak, that is Isaac, and Shifra Rivka Raskas immigrated from Kovna, Lithuania. Kovna, Lithuania is a center of Jewish study, to St. Louis to join members of Mrs. Raskas' Saracen family. They started a dairy in St. Louis. And they were probably responsible for something that is called Chol of Yisrael. What is Chol of Yisrael? Chol of Yisrael. What?
Philadelphia cream cheese.
No. Chol of means milk. Yisrael means Israel.
Bagels.
There was a time when people added the milk of non-kosher animals to regular milk. This was a fear for centuries. They would milk pigs, they would milk horses, they would milk camels, and they would mix that milk into milk from a cow. As a result, there is a Jewish law that one has to be sure that the milk that you are using is from a cow. It's not from a non-kosher source, because milk from a non-kosher source is non-kosher. Now today, since we have the milking on farms and it's all done mechanically, the possibility of mixing non-kosher milk into regular milk is virtually nil. But that was not the case then. Raskas probably had the first Chol of Yisrael. By the way, you can buy something called Chol of Yisrael milk in New York. It's milk that is supervised from the time of the milking by a Jew to make sure nothing is added. He probably had the first Chol of Yisrael dairy in America. He sent two sons to Slabodka Yeshiva. Slabodka Yeshiva is a famous yeshiva. Slabodka is near Kovna in Lithuania. In 1900, he sent his sons. Now, they didn't get on an airplane in 1900. It was an arduous journey. And they didn't pick up a cell phone and call home every morning and evening and afternoon. They couldn't do that. They got a letter maybe once every 3 weeks. One of them was 12. There was Lewis. He stayed with relatives in Kovna, and he studied in the Slabodka Yeshiva. From there, he went to a place called Radin, which also was a famous center of learning. Somebody by the name of Chafetz Chaim was a well-known, famous rabbi, Rabbi Israel Meir Kagan. In any case, there he married Ruth Pupko, who worked as a pharmacist. And he worked as a pharmacist. Not when he was 12. In 1914, his father called him home. The father and mother wanted to go to Israel to see maybe they would immigrate there. They wanted him to come home and run the farm, run the whole the dairy operation. And he figured it would be for a few months, so he left his wife, and he had two children at the time, in Lithuania. And he came back to St. Louis, and then World War I broke out. And he was trapped here, and she was trapped there. And he really had no communication with her throughout World War I. But he was able to send her money because she was an American citizen. She didn't suffer too much. But at the end of the war, she wanted him to come back to Europe. And he said, I can't leave. My parents have settled in Israel. By the way, Anne Raskas Candy is from this Raskas family. The two daughters, they had two daughters in Israel. That's where Anne Raskas Candy comes from. It's from this family. He said, I can't leave. I have this business here. You have to come here. She said, no, I don't want to leave Europe. You have to come here. She didn't know what to do. So she went to a rabbi, and he told her, look, you have one of two choices. Either you go to America, or you divorce him. So she decided to come to America. And Ruth and Louis Raskas became pillars of the St. Louis Jewish community. And when you heard of the Lubavitcher Hasidim, Chabad, they're very much in the news. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe came to America from 1929 to 1930 on a visit, and Ruth Raskas cooked for him. Now that's no small thing, because these people were concerned with kosher food, and it wasn't an easy thing. Now we'll jump to one other person, Rabbi Chaim Tzvi Schneerson. Schneerson, if anybody recognizes, that was the last name of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. Schneerson is the name of the Lubavitchers. Chabadniks. What?
He just died.
He died more than a year ago, more than 2 years ago. He died a number of years ago. He died in 1998 or something like that.
Nine years ago.
Okay. What?
He never died.
We won't get into that because that happens to be a certain controversy among certain of his followers. In any case, Chaim Zvi Schneerson, whose picture I gave out because he's such a beautiful looking fellow.
Oh, that's him?
That's him.
Really?
That's him. He really looked exotic. He was born in 1833 and he died in 1881.
Looks like Osama.
He traveled in this costume, so you can imagine the impression he made. The fez was red, and what does it say there? It says that the robe was white, and the vest was yellow, and the belt was multicolored, and he was a tumbler. What do I mean by that? He was born in Russia in 1833. And about 1840 or 41, his family immigrated to Palestine. By the way, he is a great grandson of the founder of the Lubavitcher Hasidic movement, of Rabbi Schneer Zalman of Ligadi, the Baal HaTanya. So he is he has what they call yichus in Yiddish, yichus. Yichus, what? No. Yichus.
It means
you have important family ties. You're one of the special families. He was status as a result of his lineage. He was a brilliant Talmudic scholar as a youngster, so much so that he was ordained at the age of 13. And then he became something called a mishulach, a collector for various charities in Israel. And he traveled the world. Now we're talking in the 19th century. Where did he go? He went to China. He went to India. He went to Australia. He went to Romania. He went to Paris, he went to London, and in 1869, he showed up in America.
Hoboken.
I don't know if he landed in Hoboken. You know, it's not such a joke, because when the chief rabbi of New York, Rabbi Jacob Joseph, came to America, his boat docked in Hoboken, because Hoboken was a main port. This is in 1880-something, I think. Early 1880s. So Hoboken was a main port. By the way, the boat docked on the Sabbath, and he didn't leave the boat until after the Sabbath. Thousands of people came that night from New York via ferry to welcome him. Anyway, that's another story. His life was a disaster here, an absolute disaster here. Terrible, terrible. Anyway, let's go back to Chaim Zvi Schneerson. He came to America not as a collector. He had gone to these other countries to collect for various communities in Israel to rebuild certain things, to build certain things. He came here with the idea of influencing the American government in its relationship with the Jews, something unheard of. And as I said, you see, he was very, you can look from the eyes and everything, he is certainly an impressive-looking fellow. And he managed in some way or other to get a meeting with the Secretary of State at the time, Hamilton Fish. This is in 1869. And he pleaded with Fish. The American consulate in Jerusalem had been involved in proselytizing, and he was anti-Jews, and he wanted him removed. And then he actually met with Grant. He met with President Ulysses S. Grant. And we have a recording of that meeting, as it was reported in something called the Intelligencer, about what happened. It said a long, long meeting with Grant. The bottom line was, unbelievably, Grant removed the consul and replaced him with somebody else. It was unheard. Grant issued this special order 11 in which he expelled the Jews from Kentucky, from Mississippi, and from Tennessee during the Civil War. And Lincoln had to intervene. Why? Because he... Why? That's another topic. Another talk. Now, Schneerson embarked upon a cross-country tour of America. He lectured in all sorts of places. He went all the way to California and back. And he published a book called Palestine and Romania. And in there he has testimonials. And there's one to me that's absolutely fascinating. It is a letter from Brigham Young in Salt Lake City inviting Schneerson to come to the tabernacle to speak. Unbelievable. I don't know if he ever went. I don't know if he spoke. But he was invited. In any case, he had been in Romania, and the situation for Jews in Romania was a disaster beginning in 1866. They were discriminated against. Many of them were deported indiscriminately. All Jewish farmers were thrown off of their farms. All contracts with Jews were annulled. It was a disaster. So he wanted to get an American consul appointed to Romania who was a Jew. And he wrote to Grant about this, suggesting this, and then he worked behind the scenes, and he was able to get a gentleman named Benjamin Franklin Peixoto, P-E-I-X-O-T-T-O, whose grandfather was a chazan in the Sherith Israel Synagogue, appointed as consul to Romania. Unbelievable. He was probably the first Jewish advocate who worked in politics in the American government. He left here as an American citizen. He became an American citizen. He went back to Palestine, to Jerusalem. And then in 1881 or 1882, he died collecting money in South Africa. Thank you.
You didn't leave much for 102.
There's much for 102. There is.
Would you say that this fellow was sort of the father of the Jewish rabbi in the United States?
In a certain sense, yes. Yes, he was.
Were there any other efforts before him?
Nothing.
He had two ambassadors nominated in sensitive positions.
Right. Yeah. No, he was. It was unheard. First of all, he was astounded. He was successful with the first one. And yes, I would say he was the father or grandfather of it.
So that would be 1880, roughly.
He met with in 1869 he met with Grant.
To the wall.
Yes.
I'm not sure about that. During the Revolutionary War, wasn't a Jew the treasurer or essential financier?
I meant to mention this because when I tell people about this, they say the only thing I know about American Jewish history is that Chaim Solomon financed the American Revolution. I have to tell him sorry, but he didn't. Chaim Solomon was involved in raising money for the revolutionary cause, but he himself did not have the funds to finance the American Revolution. He never financed it, but he was involved in floating bills and loans and stuff like that. It gave him political influence, but not for international things. See, Schneerson was the first, I believe, I can't be 100% sure, but the first, at least, that I know about to actually influence what the United States government did abroad. And don't forget, this is a time when the United States government was not particularly interested in world affairs, but yet he was successful, it seems.
So he was the grandfather of the Schneerson Rebbe in...
No. He's related. No. He's related. He's descended from... Right. They're all descended from the same person, and he's related. He's a cousin of a cousin or something like that. Exactly. You have to look at the whole family chart, but no. No. Well, then I thank you, folks.
Thank you.